I absolutely can't remember a time when we all gathered at my grandmother Butler's house that we weren't singing by the end of the gathering. That was just a family thing that we did, and she taught me harmony before I ever learned how to sing lead because they needed an alto part in the group.
So this was like from early childhood?
Yes. It's the earliest memory I have of childhood is her singing You Are My Sunshine in my ear, and that had to be like a 1 or 2 year old memory, you know. So music has always been a part of my life. My grandmother Butler gave me the love for music, probably the first time she ever kept me, which would have been 2 or 3 weeks old. So it's been forever.
Would you tell our listeners the story that you recount on the liner notes of your Showing My Roots CD about getting up on stage?
Yes. Now, my father is Italian and can't sing a lick. He can play a good radio, but that's about it. But he loves music. He has always loved music. And he would throw these big backyard barbecues. And, of course, our families on both sides were huge, so there would have been a lot of people there. And I guess I was about 3 years old, they tell me. I remember it, but my father had hired a bluegrass group to perform for the barbecue. And when they took a break, I eased up there and started singing Take This Hammer, because I wanted a hold of that mic. And I had the mic in my hand, and I was singing, he said, to the top of my lungs. And I didn't realize that the band was gathering behind me, and they found the key I was singing in, and they started playing along. When I opened my eyes and realized everyone was staring at me and the band was there, I took off running. Dad said, but I'd like to say that I've gotten over that. I don't run off stage mostly now.
Well, at what point did you decide to go beyond just singing with your family to being something that you would pursue on stage?
My dad heard me singing to an old Loretta Lynn 45. I guess I was about 6 or 7, and I had my Fisher-Price turntable going with that, and I'll never forget the song was When the Man of the House is Not at Home, so the subject matter was way beyond me. But I had a hairbrush hooked to a lamp cord and singing, looking in the mirror, and my dad had stood outside the door with my mom and heard me, so he comes in and cuts off the cord, duct tapes it to the hairbrush, and brings me over to my uncle's, and I had to start performing at that point, and he just became my biggest cheerleader, and they got me vocal lessons, and he bought a restaurant so that I would have a place to play, so I was singing on stage when I was about 9 or 10 with a band.
Wow.
So it started really early on for me.
Now, I don't know if you mentioned, you grew up in Virginia, correct?
Yes.
Now, at what point did you have an understanding of the rich musical culture and heritage of the area where you were growing up there in Virginia?
Early. I remember, of course, when I was singing in clubs, I was a huge fan of Emmylou Harris, and I knew that she used to perform at a place called the Purple Onion there on the strip of Virginia Beach all the time, and I knew that a lot of bluegrass music came through there all the time because my father was a big fan. I wasn't listening to it growing up like he was, but because he listened to it, I was exposed to it. Mm-hmm. So I knew that that area, and plus I had family, my uncle Curly Butler, who was into music, and he was a local star there in Richmond, Virginia, in that area. So I was exposed to a lot of that, too.
So then how did you make the transition from Virginia to Nashville?
Well, my parents decided that they would like to give me a shot at singing in a real studio. So bless their hearts, they brought me down when I was, I would say around 12 or 13, my first time. And I got to record, and I just fell madly in love with recording studios and really felt a calling for that. So when I was about 15 or 16, it became a serious thing. Like, I, you know, was begging them all the time to bring me back to record, and we started commuting back and forth. And then I fell in love, and I wanted to bring Rick, my fiancé at the time, down to see the studio that I was recording in. And we were down here. My dad brought us down here. While I was singing, my dad and Rick went and put a down payment on a condo thing, came back and informed me that after we got married, we were moving to Nashville. So that's how I got here.
Well, when you were in your late teens, were you singing classic country, contemporary country? What style of music were you performing at that point in your career?
In those days, I was always doing traditional country music. Not so much the current stuff that was out, but more my hero was Loretta Lynn and Connie Smith and Tammy Wynette. So I was doing the classic country covers at the time. But always somewhere in there, I was doing a bluegrass song done with country instrumentation. I just didn't realize that it was slowly pulling me in until I married Rick.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Rick.
Okay.
Because obviously he's been an influence on you personally and musically. You mentioned he's your fiance. Tell about how the two of you met and how you first knew who his well-known family was.
Well, I used to go to this. They had local gong shows in Norfolk, Virginia, and he was with the biggest, the most hotshot band there. It was Carolina Charlie and the Heavy Cowboys, and Rick was the bass player for them. And I remember, because I'm the only daughter of a very Italian father, my dad used to take me over there on Sundays to be in the contest. And I was 15 years old, and I was looking at the stage, and my dad said, "Why are you looking at that boy?" And I said, "I think I'm going to marry him, Daddy." And that was Rick. And I didn't really get to meet him until I was about 20 or so. When I was first introduced to him, I knew it was the man I was going to marry. But I didn't know his family background. And so we dated a while, and I got married when I was 23. And he came to me probably about 3 months before the wedding, and we were going to have a big Italian wedding. And he said, "Look, you know, if we're going to blend these two families purely and honestly, I would really like my cousin to sing at the wedding." And I said, "What cousin?" And he said, "My cousin Ralph." And I knew who Ralph Stanley was, but the truth of the matter is I never heard him sing until he sang at my reception. So he opened up my big Italian reception with "Over Yonder Stands Little Maggie," and I fell head over heels in love with bluegrass music by the third note he hit.
Wow. What a great story.
It's a true story. So I sort of married into bluegrass royalty.
You certainly did. Now, in the early 1990s, you had a mainstream country music career. You recorded for Atlantic Records. Tell us a little bit about that aspect in your musical evolution.
Well, it's a hard thing to land a major deal. I know you know that. And it's what everybody that moves here dreams of. And it happened for me in an afternoon. I had been doing demo work here in town, which is, you know, a lot of songwriters aren't great singers, so they'll hire singers to sing the songs that they write so that they can pitch them to people like Faith Hill. And I had been working really hard, and I was very busy at the time doing demos, and it was one of those demos that landed on Dale Morris's desk, and he was managing at the time Alabama, the group Alabama, and he took one listen to the song, and he called me on the phone, and he said, "Could you be at my office by 1 o'clock?" I didn't know who he was, but my husband did. So Rick brings me to Dale Morris's office at 1 o'clock. Dale said, "If you do a handshake agreement with me on management, I will have you a major record deal by later this afternoon." And I thought he was just blowing smoke, but I did it. Because I thought, well, what do I have to lose? And by 3 o'clock, I was on Atlantic Records, which is, like, unheard of. And I took the first year as a major artist, and they were very generous. They let me tour the country doing a radio promotion tour. So I got to fall in love with the way radio worked and such an education in that part of it. But just as quick as I got the deal, that's how quick I lost it. And it was just all through a political move when major label heads were moving around and they cleaned the rosters, and I was just part of that cleaning. And it broke my heart, and it really made me lose faith in, for the first time, in what I thought my dream was. So I stepped back from it, and it was through that experience that I became a writer, because it was suggested to me that I try writing, and in writing I would find my true voice. And that person was also another major record label head, and I really took offense. I really thought he was saying, "You don't have what it takes to be an artist, you know, to try writing." But he was so right on. I have recently had the chance to thank him for for breaking my heart. You don't get to do that often.
Well, that was going to be the next thing I wanted to talk to you about. What was the transition into becoming a songwriter? What was your first big break as a songwriter then?
To be honest, my first big break as a songwriter was to start writing with these masters in the craft of songwriting. You know, I'm still writing with writers that have discographies that, well, one of my favorite writing teams are Carrie and Lynn Chater, and Carrie's written things like You Look So Good in Love, and You're the First Time I Thought About Leaving, and IOU, and his list just goes on. And writing with those kinds of writers was my first big break as a writer because they taught me so much. And then I started trying to write mainstream country, but I was still too country for what they called country here. So I wasn't very successful as a writer. And then another part of me that wrote all alone started writing in a very mountain theme. And my publisher recognized it. And she said, you know what, let's just take you in there and put together a songwriter demo for you to have to sell at songwriter shows. And that's how I got to be in the bluegrass world, because when I got in there in the studio with all those wonderful players and we started recording the songs that I was writing, it just came to life. And that saying, you know, I'll find my true voice in my writing, came roaring out, because that's who I was.
So you tell me, you mentioned that mountain feeling in your songwriting. Why do you think your songs appeal to so many different bluegrass musicians, that a bluegrass picker or singer would hear one of your melodies and think, that's something that I could do?
There's a million-dollar question. I wish I could tell you what that formula is. I think what I have done is I am writing in a very commercial bluegrass way, and I know that's almost like an oxymoron, but I write radio-sounding music for the bluegrass market, and it's helping me with other cuts by other artists, because, you know, they want to be commercial, they want to get on the radio, and it just seems that's what I've been doing. I don't know why. It's a miracle.
Well, you may have already answered this, sort of, but I want to ask you directly. When you write a song, do you write it with a specific style in mind? You say, okay, this is going to be a country song, this is going to be a bluegrass song. Is that how you approach it?
These days I do. In the early days of my bluegrass writing, I was just writing what was on my heart. And these days, just like anything you do, the more you do it, the better you get at it. Now when I sit down, if you told me to try to write a mainstream country song, I would probably be tripping over it, because I'm out of that groove, and I'm in the groove of writing bluegrass. And there is a huge difference. Bluegrass allows you to be way more whimsical. It allows you so much more freedom in how you meter a song. It doesn't have to be so structured, four bars, four bars, four bars. It can be three bars, and then two bars, and then four bars, and it can be all over the place. And at the end, you have this really interesting sounding song. So I'm just really enjoying writing bluegrass music.
Now, you're in the middle of a project where you're going to help share what you've learned and your experiences in writing music. Tell us about the book that you're working on.
Well, I'm really excited about it. I just never dreamed I would be writing a book, but I've been asked lately to be part of these songwriter workshops, and I found another part of me that I didn't know existed, and that's the teacher in me. And the passion that I have for songwriting, it really bubbles forth, and I'm able to express myself in a way that helps new songwriters, and that's a real, real exciting thing for me right now. So I'm putting it in book form so that these students can also take something home with them and keep on, you know, the journey of the writer path. So it's really fun. I'm sitting every morning and writing for about 4 or 5 hours on this thing.
Well, you mentioned that your husband, Rick, plays in your band. Tell us about the other members of your band, the makeup of the group that you'll be bringing to KASU's Bluegrass Monday.
Oh, you guys have to come out and see them. They're just precious. I call them the Poor Mountain Boys. I didn't know how exciting a label I was putting on them. That means I keep the bar low. I don't have to pay them much. They work so hard for me. on the guitar is Tony King, and years ago he toured with J.D. Crow. And after his stint with J.D. Crow, he did 16 years with Brooks and Dunn as their acoustic player. And I was just fortunate enough to snag him when he got off the road. And on banjo is Greg Davis, and in his past he used to tour with Sam Bush. And on mandolin is John Martin, and on upright bass is Bill Baldock. And they make up the Four Mountain Boys along with Rick Stanley.
And so when you get together, how would you describe one of your concerts? What do you guys sound like? What do you play when you're together?
Well, we play my music off the albums, and they do a really good job representing that. And they have a bunch of songs that they also do that are covers and things that I think the audience just eats up. And they're just genuinely good friends, and I think that translates. And it's a good all-around experience.
The bluegrass community, as you well know now, there's something very unique about the spirit of people who play this style of music. Is this something that you've known about since your childhood, or you've learned more as you've gotten deeper and deeper into mainstream bluegrass music?
It's something I've learned, and I'll share this story with you, because I came out of the commercial country world, and here in Nashville, everything is a dollar. Every minute is a big dollar bill. And when you go in a studio and you've booked that studio, say, from 10 until 6 that evening, when that 10 o'clock mark strikes, those musicians should be playing your song and starting to record, because from that point on, that's a lot of money, you know, ticking away. Well, when we did my first bluegrass album, I had never worked with bluegrass musicians. We get in there at 10 o'clock. I've got 14 songs to record in 3 days, so that's quite a lot of work. And at 10 o'clock, they start tinkering. That's the only way I can describe it. And they kept doing this G run over and over again. Of course, at the time, I didn't even know it was called a G run. I thought, oh my goodness, they only know the one lick. So it was bum, ba dum, ba dum, bum. And everybody took turns doing it over and over again. And it just sounded like, if you can imagine, an orchestra tuning up. But these guys did it for an hour. It's like they had to work the bugs out. But of course, I'm sweating, like, you know, I broke out into a sweat thinking, oh no, you know, here's all the money gone that we had set aside for my project. But when they looked at each other at 11 and all the bugs were gone, I remember the producer leaning over and said, are y'all ready to put it down? And from that point on, it flew. And we did 14 songs in 2 days, and it was the most incredible music I have ever been involved with. These guys are some of the best musicians I've ever worked with in my entire life. It's so incredible to watch them and to see their genius.
Well, we are so excited to welcome you and the Poor Mountain Boys to KASU's Bluegrass Monday. We're excited about it, and we'll see you Monday night.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.